Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. And in the studio with me are a few fine young men. Alex Pfeiffer is in the studio together with Lucas Bliley, a young Ames newsmaker who has just published a novel at age 14. And folks, I've read it, so I'm going to talk to him about that. After the break, Max Ennis will be here with a Teen Zone report produced by himself and Thea Brenner. And, of course, it being Friday, we'll also be letting you know what's going on in Ames this weekend. I'll give you a hint. It sounds like this. That's right. It's motorcycle night here on Main Street in Ames tonight. And at the end of the hour, we'll be talking with the MC of that event to get a taste of what's to come. Okay, then. Alex Pfeiffer is the project's coordinator for the Ames Historical Society, located one building north of us here on Douglas. And he's been helping us get more deeply acquainted with the streets of Ames in a regular segment we're calling Why Is That? Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thanks, Greta. Thanks for having me.
So in last month's segment of Why Is That, we learned about Northwestern, a street that runs diagonally in central Ames. It just so happens in the northwestern direction. But don't let that fool you. The real reason the street is named Northwestern...
The Northwestern Railroad used to run right down that street.
Right down the middle of the street.
The Chicago Northwestern, that's right.
So our Why Is That question for today continues that theme. It relates to West Street in Campus Town, which branches off from Highland Avenue right there at the quaint little barber shop and passes through a little business zone before continuing on a couple blocks and dead-ending at a T intersection. So, Alex, we have two questions. First of all, is West Street another trick name that really has nothing to do with direction? It is in the west of Ames, after all.
Yeah, it is. And it does come out of Westgate, out of Iowa State campus. So it could be confusing that it could just be the direction. But I actually believe that it's named after Ames's first mayor, William West.
So second of all, that business zone there. We got Mother's Pub, West Street Deli, Rose Tree Yarn. Seems like most business zones of Ames are on or adjacent to the main perpendicular arteries.
In fact, that used to be one of the main arteries through Ames when the Lincoln Highway was established in 1914. It didn't go west all the way through town. When it came from downtown to Campus Town, it turned north on Sheldon Avenue and turned up and went to Ontario Street, because they were using all the better roads that were already constructed to make their way across the country. So rather than make a nice new road straight through town, they just decided to jog up north, which brought that business section really near in that direction. And so at that point, we had two kind of Campus Town areas kind of fighting to be the central business district, the south part of campus, which we know today is Campus Town or Docktown, and we had the West Street area. And there's a few things that really kind of helped the south area take off. In 1917, they started to beautify the southern half of campus by adding Lake Laverne and building some other buildings down there. And you also had, in 1923, we established the Zoning Commission, which A.L. Champlin was on. Now, A.L. Champlin owned all the buildings south of campus, so I'm sure that he would have rather seen his little area prosper rather than the West Street one. And so today we have this little special zoning over in the West Street area that still exists today just for this. It's not even almost a whole block. It's just like this side of the intersection, this side of the intersection, and that's it. We believe that this street, you know, though, is still named after William West, who's the first mayor, and for whatever reason, we're unsure, resigned 3 months into his first term. It was just going to be a one-year term.
Maybe it was all that zoning politics that was... Oh, but it wasn't – that hadn't been established yet.
Yes, this would have been in 1870 when William West was mayor, just after we incorporated, became from a village to a city in 1870, so about 6 years after Ames got started. And he was the proprietor of the West Street Hotel, which is would have been across the street where the Octagon building is today. It was torn down and later renamed the Arlington Hotel and a few other names.
Okay. And, of course, we know the Champlin name from the recent – demolition of one of the oldest buildings on that South Campus Town part on the corner of Welch and Lincoln Way.
Yeah, that's correct. He built that whole block from Welch to the Cranford apartments. So we had those, the Varsity and the New Ames Theater, and what a lot of people might remember as the old People's Drug building there. So okay. that was the first brick building built in Campustown, 1908.
Anything else to tell us about West Street there?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit. All those buildings that are over there, pretty much like the Mother's Pub, that was built in 1926 originally as Peyton and Sons Meat Market and was a grocery store up until the 70s, I believe. The Rose Tree is one of the earlier buildings there, and that was built in 1916 as the Athletic Drug Store. And if you go up there, you can still see the name on the top of the building there.
Well, it's a charming little part of town that is fun to explore.
Mm-hmm, certainly.
All right. Well, Alex Pfeiffer, thank you so much for your contribution to Why Is That?
No problem. We'll see you next month.
Okay. Our next guest, I think, is making Ames history. He's Lucas Bliley is one of the teen kids who have become known as the Fort Kids for building a fort in Munn Woods. And then he and his friends had to tear it down when flooding eroded the bank it was built upon, much to the relief of the city of Ames, who was asking them to tear down the fort. He and his cohort have challenged the city of Ames to reconsider its policy regarding temporary structures in the parks, arguing that kids need wild places to go, hang out, and experience nature. However, Lucas is not here to talk about fort building today. Last month, a novel that he has written, The Scavengers, came out in print and was delivered to our studio. I have read that novel from beginning to end, all 333 pages.
So, is it any good?
That is the voice of Lucas's older brother, Jonah DeGeest, who is here in the studio doing our engineering. Jonah, you haven't read the book?
No, I haven't.
What a good older brother you are.
Yep.
Okay, well, I will state my qualifications, first of all, as a literary critic. I am not one, but I am trained as one. I have a PhD in literature, and I will say this book is not only readable, folks, but it is fairly well realized and satisfying on several levels. And I'm really glad to have a chance to speak with the author this morning. So I'll summarize. The book is a science fiction adventure story set 500 years from now on our fair planet Earth, which is now called the Wasteland, and which can add to its geological core, mantle, and crust another skin of solid trash, dumped on it by trash crafts, which make daily flights through a wormhole from the New Earth, the planet where most of the Earthlings moved after global warming got the better of this one. The novel features 16-year-old narrator Zane and his friends, who pick through the trash and bring it back to their homes called the Wagons, cobbled together out of shipping containers and scrap metal. Is that about right, Lucas?
Yeah, that is correct.
So the first third of the book introduces us to life on the Wasteland, which is populated by wild animals that seem to have evolved a bit in the 500 years they were given. Wolf-like creatures called volves that run in packs, and elephant-like creatures called treefs, who have, I guess, a nasty set of teeth,
yes,
as well as their tusks and so forth. So the boys not only scavenge, but they hunt and practice their combat skills. Then the plot moves forward with circumstances that both require the boys to travel to the New Earth and give them a tool by which they can do this. So this New Earth is also called the Clean World by those who were abandoned here on Earth. There are a lot of themes running through the book, and two of them are mentioned in this last sentence about the clean world and being abandoned here on Earth. First, and perhaps most obvious, is this sense of abandonment. When you think about the environmental disaster that has precipitated the plot, global warming and its consequences, it's not hard to make the association between this author's age or the narrator's age and this concept of abandonment. By polluting our environment, ignoring the signals of global warming, are we not, in fact, abandoning the next generation, shouldering them with a burden we created? Is that what you intended, Lucas?
Well, I think that was definitely part of it. When you are a kid and you are going to grow up in a world where climate change is going to have a direct effect on your life, you do look at people who are older than you who just continue living the way they always have and don't really do a whole lot to care about your future and just keep on living how they always have.
And, you know, there are other people who are abandoned by our society as well, who I think of because they're the scroungers, the scavengers, people who live outside the cash economy and have to find food and furniture and everything else from scrap piles.
Yeah.
There's that whole aura of you know, the trash pickers who are really all over the world scavenging the waste of the privileged class. And then the second, perhaps even more interesting theme is this notion of cleanliness. The clean world is this other world that the kids think about a lot. It's the new world where supposedly the inhabitants have figured out a better way of living. And this theme is, you know, emphasized by the boys whenever they find soap in what they've been scavenging. They just love getting clean and getting all the grime off their skin after living lives among trash. But in the book, it seems like there's a hidden cost behind this notion of clean. Is that – can you comment on that?
Yeah, I definitely portray the clean world as a paradise, like, that all the people in the wasteland want to be in. It's all the people in the wasteland want to be in the clean world. And the clean world, yes, I portray it as paradise, but as it comes under, like, closer investigation, they start to realize that it's not great in every way. It has this perfect, like, look to it. It looks clean, but underneath that cleanliness, there's these darker secrets. And also, when the characters are striving to be clean, it's very difficult. Everything around them is dirty. And so what you sacrifice for being clean is a lot of your time and even some of your comfort.
And some of the associations I make with that is, like, somebody might go out to Target or whatever and get all new stuff and have a nice home and it's clean and it looks nice, but some of the stuff is created by using materials that are scarce or polluting our environment, or it's made with slave labor and in poor conditions. And so there's kind of this dark side to what seems nice and finished and polished on the outside.
Yeah, definitely. And also, I think these characters in my book, they don't have a clean home or a nice home or, like, a well-finished home. They live in this cobbled-together wagon. And even though it's not, like, your perfect home, everybody in the wagon is still very content. They're happy. They have hope. They talk. They play games. Although it's not your regular clean life, it's still not a bad life. And that's what I really wanted to portray, that you can make a happy life without all this stuff. Without a big house, without a car, without all sorts of fancy things you don't need. And so that's what I was trying to write a bit.
Yeah, you really work with that contrast between the two worlds. It's a great device for your novel to develop some of these themes. And the narration of the book itself is very confident and thoughtful. The mind of Zane considers and weighs the larger implications of his actions in a way that gains our interest and confidence. I thought, Lucas, maybe we could have you read a passage or two from the book.
Yeah, sure. This first passage is coming from page 50. Okay.
And Zane is describing one of his friends who happens to be named Luke. Mm-hmm. So don't let that confuse you, folks.
Okay. Despite really liking to destroy things, Luke also really likes to build things, whether that be a catapult that shoots trash at approaching wolves or a pulley system that brings him food from the kitchen right to his room. Everything he builds, no matter how impractical, is pretty amazing for only having trash to work with. Luke's imagination and his underlying optimism of reaching the clean world is more than enough incentive to build awesome things. Even if Luke never makes it to the clean world, he will still be able to find a nice job in Scumford, working in a forge or a shop. I personally have no clue what I want to do with my life, and I can only see myself as a walker for the rest of time. So what are you going to make? I ask, moving across the room, plopping down into a beanbag. Looking at me as though I am supposed to know, said Luke, smiling. Let's just see what happens. Seeing what happens is basically the daily life of a scavenger. You never really know what's going to happen or what you're going to find among the trash. In the end, being a scavenger is just being persistent, getting lucky, and seeing what happens. Because really, we have no control and nothing is guaranteed.
Lucas Bailey, I wondered whether this tinkering process that the character Luke is described as undertaking, just playing with stuff, seeing what comes of it, is something like your experience of writing this novel.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I never wrote a book before, so everything I tried was taking experiences I have, taking other books I've read and how they write and their writer's craft, and combining it in different ways until, boom, I have something. I didn't know it was going to happen, but here it is.
And about the plot, there were parts that you didn't know and maybe parts that you knew.
Yeah, I did not. When I started this book, I had the setting down. I had the clean world in my mind. I had the wasteland in my mind. And I had these wagons that moved across this wasteland. But that's all I had. I only had the setting. So basically, the characters, what the characters did, how the characters changed, that all came as I wrote.
So tell me, what was your writing, let's see, practice like? You know, did you do it in the evening? How long? How did an eighth grader produce a 333-page novel?
Well, okay, I started the seventh grade about November. And so basically I would write whenever I could. So no homework, nothing really to do. I'd write a page or two. And then as I approached eighth grade, I had a first draft, and that first summer I spent editing it over and over again every single day of the summer. And then this last year has actually been a lot of waiting and getting illustrations and more editing and getting some formatting done, and then finally it was published. So
much of it was written when you were 13 years old.
Yeah.
For those of you who've just joined us, I am talking with 14-year-old Lucas Bailey, author of Scavengers, a novel that just came out. Lucas just entered Ames High School as a freshman this year and is one of the so-called fort kids who built a fort in Munn Woods this summer and who are arguing for their right to do so. Lucas is going to read another passage from the novel now. Spoiler alert, this one comes at the end of the novel when the five friends, along with one other they've picked up along the way, have boarded a trash craft. Remember, those are the giant spaceships that travel between the new Earth or the clean world and the wasteland through a wormhole, dumping their trash on the wasteland. So now they're headed for the clean world. And here is narrator Zane.
Being on a spacecraft should be fun. Zooming through darkness at almost the speed of light through galaxies and stars. It's the experience people dream of having. But if the truth be told, it totally sucks. And after a while, it's scary. I am 100% trapped in a metal box, and I am scared of colliding with an asteroid or losing oxygen and succumbing to a horrible death where my internal organs could explode and float off into space, scattered through the stars in a not-so-milky, milky way. Besides that, I am also unimaginably bored. I feel as though I am back on the barge, helpless to do anything until we arrive at our destination. And, in fact, helpless to do anything at all. I find myself sitting the hours away in my chair, staring at the wall, trying in vain to amuse myself. Another problem, the walls are white metal, without a single flaw, mark, scratch, or imperfection of any kind. Stupid of me, but I'm already feeling homesick for my cluttered mess of a room back in the wagon, where life in the wasteland is so interesting, so unique. I start to see the truth in what the commander said about thinking for oneself. Being creative now appears to be a thing of the past. I'm already struggling with it. I mean, how are you supposed to find creativity in an almost empty room with blank white walls? Not that I'm a doctor, but I had diagnosed myself with homesickness, spacecraft sickness, and deprivation of anything that is not uniformly manufactured. Don't get me wrong. I'm happy to be on my way to the clean world, but also a small part of me wants to go back to the wagons and the life I am used to, the Zane way of life. Also, I don't like the commander either. Sure, she's a rebel, and sure, she's on our side. But come on, humans are supposed to have more than one emotion, and more than one tone of voice. However, the commander makes do with only one of each. She speaks with authority, but not a good authority. She is a commander, but that doesn't mean everyone else is of lesser value than she. What I'm trying to say is I will sure be happy when the last day of my journey on the trash gaft comes.
Okay. So there again, we have that contrast between the wasteland and the clean world, a world of creativity and one of sterility. This passage also brings up one of the narrator's preoccupations. What are the qualities of a good leader? And there are three leader figures in the book, adults whose actions intrigue the young Zane, who is also already something of a leader himself. Lucas, this is something you must think about, the qualities of a leader and the importance of leadership.
Yeah, the leaders in my book are not like your stereotypical hero, stereotypical perfectly strong, able person. The leaders in my book are more, they have that side of being confident and being capable, but every single one has a secret or another side to them. And I did that because I really wanted to stray from just, yeah, the bad guy, good guy. I wanted characters that were unique and that hadn't been done before and that really illustrated that even though they're leaders, even though they're important, that they're not perfect. So,
yeah, and the leaders are very open with those that they are leading. Well, not always. Sometimes it takes a little bit of action to have the secret spill out. But for instance, your leader, Leon, of the wagon train, he talks openly with the kids about his fears and concerns. And that was kind of interesting to see that happen in the book.
Yeah, we live in a kind of a world where that doesn't really happen. Our politicians don't really seem like people that you would want to sit down and have like a conversation with. Or that you even could sit down and have a conversation with. They're like these figureheads or these perfectly manicured people. But I really wanted to portray that they probably aren't, that they are people who have secrets and that nobody's actually like these leaders that are portrayed in society and in a lot of books. So,
Well, and speaking of sitting down with leaders or potential leaders, I know that you are among some youth who sat down with Bernie Sanders a week or two ago?
Yeah, I got a talk with Bernie Sanders, and he was the kind of politician that I like to think I portrayed, somebody who you could sit down and have a conversation with and seemed like a person that you could be friends with and not just a figurehead. So that was really cool.
What did you talk to him about? What did you say your concerns were?
My concern, well, if we're going to go back to the people who have been abandoned, I was asking about the Native Americans because I had gone to a Native American reservation and seeing that there was a 90% unemployment rate on that reservation, and these people are kind of abandoned. These are like the people on the wasteland. And so that's what I asked the question about what Bernie Sanders was going to do about the Native Americans. He acknowledged the fact that it was very bad what we had done to the Native Americans, but he didn't give a explanation of what he was going to do to help them. So
it's a complex situation.
Yeah.
They are a nomad group, like your nomad group, but who are now in a halfway society, halfway between the wasteland and maybe a different life that they previously led. Well, Lucas, it is a very great pleasure for me to meet you and have you in the studio. How can others get a copy of your fabulous book?
There's a website. It's www.tipsyphoenix@appspot.com. There's a link on that website. You can buy it off CreateSpace. You can also search it on Amazon. It's there. You have to be kind of specific. So search The Scavengers by Lucas Bliley, Amazon, and it should come up. I also have a bunch of copies. So if you know me or know my mom or have my email or just get in contact with me and I can get you a copy.
Okay. And we'll have some of those links on our website when this is posted at the end of the day by webmaster Ron Carson. Okay, well, we will turn to Wildwood, a four-piece band out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, that will be playing Sunday night at Bluestem, a family-friendly music venue in West Ames.
see you in a lemon moon, all alone. Cloudy mirrors and dirty window panes, they hide the lines in your face.
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, today. And we have just been joined by Max Ennis of the Teen Zone Report. And in fact, we have a Teen Zone Report coming up. Max, you are listening to Lucas Bliley. I just interviewed 14-year-old, just so talented. Talking to youth who are so accomplished really makes you feel optimistic about our world's future, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, totally.
Unless you're feeling...
Yeah.
Cynical.
Mm-hmm.
So you and your co-creator, Thea Brenna, have come up with a Teen Zone segment on...
cynicism.
What should we know about that before we listen?
You're in for a good time. It's going to be educational. It's going to be fun.
Should we buckle our seatbelts or what?
I don't know. If you're feeling too cynical, you don't really need to buckle your seatbelts because it's like what's the point even? But right. I would suggest.
That's so passé in a way.
Yeah, it's very belts. It's very kind of edgy and rebellious.
Okay.
But I advise buckling a seatbelt. I'm a lifeguard. I'm very safety-minded.
Okay. That would be what you call a disclaimer.
Yes.
Okay.
Welcome to the Teen Zone Report, where we inspect national trends and events through a local lens shrouded in humor. Your laughter is guaranteed.
Before we introduce our honored guest, we here at the Teen Zone thought it might be behoove of us to define political cynicism, at least in how we will be referencing it throughout the show.
Political cynicism is defined by Capella and Jameson as mistrust generalized from particular leaders or political groups to the political process as a whole, a process perceived to corrupt the persons who participated in it and that draws corrupt persons as participants. We're going to focus, as I mentioned previously, on how disillusion in the political process is propelled by the firestorm of drama and ugliness that is today's 24-hour media cycle, a cycle that whirls and topples headfirst onto every screen possessed by the American public.
We are going to interview up-and-coming political science student Christopher Jackson.
Without further ado, we'd like to welcome Christopher Jackson to the show.
Hi, everybody.
Chris, tell us what it is like to be in the elite few who have read Plato's Republic.
Well, I would say that every concerned citizen needs to read that fabulous work of ancient political science. But as for what it's like to be in what I would say is the 1% of people who have read it, it's something that you really have to experience before you can understand anything about political life.
Truly enlightening.
All right. So who are you and what do you do?
Well, I'm a political science major at the University of Iowa. I'll be joining their debate team in the fall. I graduated from Ames High in 2014, and I'm a very, very loyal Democrat.
How have you seen political cynicism affecting university life?
Well, the thing is, Thea, that what ends up happening is that the people who should be most concerned with political life, those who are going to be living through the decisions that we make in the next few years, we're going to have to be living with it for the rest of our lives. Climate change is a prime example of this. But the way that it really affects students is that not only are they disinterested in the issues, but they show an active disregard for being involved in political life. It's not merely that they don't care or they don't see a difference between the two parties or whether it's worth it being involved in the political process, but they actually have distaste for those who are. as a brief anecdote as to the level of cynicism and apathy on campus, recently, there about a couple of years ago, there was a law that was passed to kick under 21s out of the bars after 10 p.m. And the despite the fact that the election was held when students were back in town, the measure passed nonetheless. So when students aren't even able to vote for something like allowing underclassmen into the bars, I mean, how do you think we're going to be enacting a political revolution?
Has something allowed you specifically to regain faith in the political system? And if so, what was it?
Well, I'd say in general terms, no. My cynicism and lack of respect for the possibilities of political life has only deepened since President Obama took office. I don't attribute it to him except insofar as, you know, when he was elected, we all thought this is like a generational change and that we will be able to finally confront the problems that we have head on. And I think really we haven't been able to do that. I do feel a little bit of hope, what I would call democratic hope, from Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who I think is really starting to reignite the grassroots. But I also feel like what this might be is just him getting all the old crusty liberals up and excited. And I don't know if whether or not that's necessarily spreading to people whom, like we were discussing earlier, apathetic people who were turned off from the process.
What do you consider are the driving forces behind political cynicism?
I think that it comes from a couple of things. One is that ever since Watergate, the American people and the narrative that they're fed and they've come to believe is that, you know, all politicians are crooks. And it's not merely that, you know, the political parties don't necessarily have a difference or that they won't do things, but they actually think that engaging in political life is dirty in some way. I think that we also get, in a related way, a sort of cycle where we say, well, they're all crooks, so it's not worth it for us to get involved. And then what happens is, what a surprise, we don't, you know, the citizenry doesn't, you know, show the oversight that it needs to keep crooks out. I mean, you can use the Jack Abramoff example or even Benghazi. I mean, God knows that was a dark stain on this nation's character. But in all seriousness, though, I think that the reason that it comes about, and it really comes back to history with Watergate and the destruction of American idealism with the Vietnam War as well.
How much of the Congo by Vashon Lindsay would you say you have memorized at this moment in time?
I would say that I have just as much of that memorized as I would say that the amount of that I have memorized is just as same the amount smarter that I think Rick Perry is after he put his big boy glasses on, which is to say, not at all. Big fat zero.
According to a Washington Post article following the 2014 midterms, in that election, voter turnout was at its lowest since World War II. What factors do you think led to that decline?
Many Democrats have said they thought that it was because the Democratic Party was running away from President Obama's record, and thus, as such, they weren't trying to galvanize the base. I don't think that was really true. I think the reason why turnout dropped so much was because people weren't really given a reason to vote. And what always happens is that with regards to politics specifically, the Democratic constituencies, which is to say minorities, poor people, and the young, tend to usually vote less in midterm elections because, again, they are more likely to they're less likely to turn out in the first place. But as for why the number of votes was so low in 2014, I would say that it's probably because that the political climate was so toxic that people thought that by going to cast a vote, they were in some way saying that they not necessarily approved, but were willing to participate in the process. And so by refusing to vote or by giving into their cynicism, that they were, again, not dirtying their hands with politics.
Well, thank you for your time, Mr. Jackson. It was a pleasure.
Well, thank you as well, Max. It's a pleasure to see you. And as always, Thea, you're a delight.
And now for some human interest stories.
A distant news station recently ran a story covering an interview in which a candidate accidentally said that if elected, he would give all cats a flat tax, meaning, of course, that all mats would be given a flat tax. There was reasonable outrage from both the cat and the mat constituencies, and a media firestorm erupted. While the politician tried to claim that it was merely a slip of the tongue, all invested parties agreed that the cat was out of the bag. The news station that had obtained the interview played the clip multiple times an hour, and even had a small segment on its nightly news show called Local Politicat Talks Smack About Matt's Spats. and the candidate tried to cover his tracks to no avail. Once the story had faded, the candidate's approval rating dropped to a shockingly low numbers. By the time the election was over, the carpet was completely swept out from underneath him. However, the same news station, after analyzing the data from the local polling centers, noticed that less cats and mats voted in the election than previously before, and that the Bat Party actually won the majority.
A local man has joined us in our studio to tell his story of the corrupted atmosphere of politics and how it has personally affected him. To protect the identity of our subjects, all names will be omitted. My son began getting interested in politics in 2012 or so when I had him tag along to the Republican caucus with me. After that, he began paying way more attention to the news. He would just get so angry at dinner over what you'd see on the news, and I started to notice he was giving off a dark glow. And it's not like a moody teen, like Nirvana kind of glow. It's like, you look like you've been blessed by our Dark Lord Hades kind of glow.
Odd.
He began to volunteer for various political action committees, reading all the papers and taking university classes on political philosophy. His eyes grew to be a shade of blood crimson, and his voice adopted a demonic echo. I was worried about him, and I tried to give him a one-to-one with him in his room. He caught on fire and threatened to sacrifice me to the Dark Lord. Last week, he began an internship with the Marco Rubio campaign and consequently grew to be 9 feet and developed a lovely shade of magenta skin. He has turned my house into a castle fashioned out of brimstone. If anyone knows a good Catholic priest, please send me an email at hopefulabraham@yahoo.com. Absolutely touching. Absolutely touching.
Amazing. Really amazing. Now, I work at a minimum wage job at a local coffee shop that I adore, and while I may have very little control over my work days, I am allowed to decide what music to listen to while I work. Recently, while on a certain Pandora station, I heard this song by Of Montreal. The title of the track is Bassem Sabri, named after an Egyptian pro-democracy activist who fell off a balcony in April 2014. While it has an upbeat rhythm and melody, I would encourage listening closely to the lyrics by Of Montreal singer and lyricist Kevin Barnes. Here's Bassem Sabri.
Guitars, and if not for the good people weeping, all we'd hear is sounds of our horses dying. But I'm not about to start crying about it. It must be fairly normal to devolve into cyclopic brooding at the genocidal massacres erupt over some perceived sedition, insecurities of men messing everything up again. Tramp of cold voltage, crucifixion is my conduit. I just watched my hero fail. Now I'm in a dark and violent funk. Every leader is a cellophane punk. If you hear me say yeah, 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 there must be a softer vision that you could.
Political cynicism is something that dominates the American political psyche at this day. Voter turnout is at one of the lowest points it has been in the history of our nation's elections, and it has been decreasing. Our politicians have some of the lowest favorability ratings ever.
As we heard in our interview with Christopher Jackson, people seem to be pushed away by politics and the apparent corruption that comes with it. Just under 40% of people voted in the 2014 election. But this isn't forcing politicians to respond to the will of the people.
The greatest political movements in this country were supported with high voter turnout. The 1860 election, when Abraham Lincoln was elected, had nearly 80% of people voting. The beginning of antitrust law and workers' protections was backed up by years of high voter turnout.
In the years leading up to the Great Depression, voter turnout was at some of the lowest it had been in presidential election years. Our politicians can't be reined in by one candidate that we think is a really nice guy. They can only be held accountable if a majority of the nation is voting and telling politicians what they think and actively advocating for values they personally believe in.
All in all, voting in elections is not going to corrupt the participants through exposure to a corrupt political climate. It's been shown to purify corruption in the past, and it might just do the trick today.
Today, we have taken a look at how political cynicism affects the way we see political corruption, and we've found that cynicism, while popular and prevalent, does in fact encourage corruption, not reduce it. Remember to register to vote early and participate in as many elections as possible.
This has been the Teen Zone Report. Thank you for listening, and we hope to reach you again.
And that was Max Ennis and Thea Brenner of Ames High, and this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. In the final minutes of the show, we're going to look forward to tonight's event on Main Street in Ames, where it is Bike Night, the first ever Bike Night, in fact. And just to clarify, this is the kind of bike we're talking about. And we have on the line the MC of this event, who I understand goes by the moniker of Pipes. Pipes, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
All right.
So,
good morning.
Good morning. Well, good morning, good afternoon. This show re-airs in the afternoon, and then it will be re-airing again at 7 p.m. right in the middle of the event. The event is 5 to 9 tonight on Main Street, where there is motorcycle-only parking on Main Street and a band and you as MC, right?
Yes, that is correct. It's going to be a community event for sure.
And this is the first ever one in Ames, so I don't really know what a bike night is. Could you describe to me what goes on?
Well, I certainly can, because I happen to have the good fortune to work with the other larger bike nights in the area. We have Indianola does one this third Friday, Winterset the third Saturday, and Newton does one the second Friday. And what it is, it's a big social event. Motorcyclists are going to ride in from all over the area and get together and talk about things that they like to talk about their motorcycles, the riding, where they've ridden, and check each other's bikes and what they've done to customize them. So it's really just a big social event.
Yeah, and now do the businesses along the street participate in this or in some way? Or
yes, when I was talking with Matt Miracle, the general manager at the Harley dealer there, he said that some of the businesses are going to remain open and be doing different things. And, of course, the bars will be doing things. I know one of the bars will have Richard Ark will be playing, and he was at the bike night last night that was in Marshalltown. So it's a big entertainment night, and you know, there's most of them are family friendly events also, where it's really great, and I love having the ones in Indianola and Winterset and Newton, where there's the kids will dance to the bands, and I buy little things on clearance like bubble wands, and I've got a big tub of chalk that I'll let the kids do some sidewalk art, and we'll give them prizes for that kind of stuff. So it really is a wonderful, good time for even if you aren't a motorcycle rider.
Huh. So as MC, part of the event, part of your job is to hand out bubble wands to kids?
Well, that's something I do on my own. The kids are our future. And you've got to show the kids that they're appreciated and they're loved, and it makes for a, you know, it's a good thing to do. But no, I take money out of my pocket and buy things on clearance. So, you know, and you know, the kids, like I said, the kids are everything, man.
That's sweet. So, do kids ride on motorcycles? How are they going to get there?
Well, a lot of them, in some of the towns, it's the town people will come in and to, you know, check out all the motorcycles, the bands, you know, people watching. They'll come in, you know, in strollers, and kids can ride on the back of a motorcycle, you know.
They can?
Recommended that kids, yeah. Yeah, most definitely.
Really? So what is there, yeah. I'm sorry, I'm just interested in this. Is there a minimum age?
Sure. I don't know exactly because not participating with having a child that young, but I know when I, well, of course, I'm in my 50s, but I rode on the motorcycle with my stepfather when I was like 4.
Wow.
So you just have to hold on.
Wow. It's a little dicier than riding on a tractor. So, and there's...
Well, yeah, but a lot more fun, maybe.
And it looks like there's a band, the J. Clyde Band, playing country
yes.
and southern rock, cover band.
Yes, yes. And I have spoke with a gentleman ahead of the times to let him know that I was going to be there and to find out what the kind of stuff they were doing. And it's a local band that's been around for like some 30-odd years. So that's one of the type of bands that you like to work with that have been around and know what they're doing. It's pretty much your more basic, popular late 70s, early 80s
All right.
rock and roll type.
Anything else you'd like to tell us about this bike night here in Ames?
It's a free event, and even if you're not a motorcyclist, you can come down and check stuff out. And there's, you know, it is an amazing thing to see this many like-minded people getting together and enjoying the evening, each other's company, listening to some music, you know, enjoying the company of other people that like to ride motorcycles. And it is really great to see some of these motorcyclists letting the kids see their bikes, and some of them will, you know, let them sit on it occasionally, but you never sit on a motorcycle without asking. And you know, so it really is a family event and a community event, and it's great for a community because motorcyclists will ride a few hundred miles to come to go someplace,
right?
Because they like to ride. So when you have an event like Ames is doing, you're bringing in people from outside the area to expose them to the things in your town, the merchants in your town. It's a very positive thing all the way around for the community.
Okay, well, we have to wrap it up.
I look forward to seeing everybody out there, and if you're out there and you see me, you'll be able to tell who I am. Make sure you let me know that you were listening to this great radio station and found out about Ames Bike Night on Main Street tonight, 5 to 9 p.m.
Okay, and we're hoping for good weather, better weather than we're having right now.
And, well, we all know this is Iowa. It can look like it's going to become a big storm's coming and nothing. So until it's raining on you, don't even consider looking at the sky, because we know it cannot. It can look like it's going to rain. Last night at Marshalltown, it was like, man, everyone was like, it looked like it's going to rain. And there was maybe a drop or two, but nothing.
Right.
So we got to remember, this is Iowa. Blink and the clouds will change and it won't rain.
All right, Pipes. You have a great day.
All right. Thank you so much, Greta. You too. Bye now.
Okay, and as is our tradition on Fridays here on Local Talk, we've got a list of candidate events to attend in Central Iowa in the upcoming days. Today, Friday, Carly Fiorino will be in Ames at the Iowa State University Presidential Caucus Series at 3 p.m., and on Saturday, she will be at the Iowa Corn Growers Association Annual Meeting at the Embassy Suites Hotel in Des Moines at 8. Rick Santorum will be at the Iowa State Historical Museum in Des Moines on Tuesday at 11:30. Martin O'Malley and Lincoln Chafee will be at a forum on immigration called Unite Iowa on Immigration, which will be held at Buena Vista University in Storm Lake on Saturday. That starts at 2:30, and KHOI will be recording it and bringing you highlights from it on Monday during Local Talk. Later that same day, I've heard that Martin O'Malley will be at Stomping Grounds in Ames at 7 p.m. You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started off the hour with Alex Pfeiffer, Projects Director at the Ames Historical Society, with our regular feature, Why Is That? We were then joined by Lucas Bliley, a 14-year-old who has written and published a book, The Scavengers.
A book. Good job, Lucas.
That's older brother Jonah DeGeest, who is our engineer today. We also had a Teen Zone report with Max Ennis and Thea Brenner and Talk to Pipes, the MC for Motorcycle Night tonight in Ames, Bike Night, first annual. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOY at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's entire Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoyfm.org. That's khoyfm.org. There you'll also find information about the people you heard today, including a link to the aforementioned book by Lucas Bliley, and so on and so forth, contact information, and all you want to know. Local Talk was engineered, as I said, by Jonah DeGeest, who is no second fiddle to his brother, by the way. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was The Other Side by Wildwood, a band playing at Bluestem on Sunday out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, which means you can be part of our team of volunteer reporters. We'll train you and you will learn and love more about our community than you ever dreamed. We do. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, so contact us at 292-2878 or through our website, khoyfm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience is what makes KHOY possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Killers on the bloodshot streets. On down in the tunnel with a deadly horizon. Oh, I swear I saw a young boy down in the gutter. He was starting to foam in the heat. Oh, baby, you're the only thing in this whole world that's good and good and right. And wherever you are and wherever you go, there's always gonna be some light. But I gotta get out, I gotta break it out now, before the final crackle of dawn. So we gotta make the most of our one night together. When it's over, you know we'll both be so alone. Damn, dancing through the night.